This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
Oh, I think that's me. Hello, everybody. Oh, a beautiful Sunday. Thanks for spending part of that with us here at WNRN. Let me thank the folks down in Lovingston on that 94.7. And you know, no matter where you are, maybe you want to support Del Foss Vineyards and Winery in Faber, because they're having a good show going on today at noon. They invite you to lunch on the lawn from noon till 3 p.m. right after we finish up. Food will be available and music from Grit City Grass. More info, directions are at Del Foss. That's D-E-L-F-O-S-S-E, wine.com, or at 263-6100. Check it out after the wake-up call. Interesting show today, as they're all interesting, but today we're going to be talking about leadership with University of Virginia Professor Tom Bateman. He's from the McIntyre School of Commerce. Tom, how are you?
Just fine, Rick. Good morning to you.
And thank you for coming in, because it is a beautiful Sunday. And hopefully people are listening from their yard with the radio cranked or driving along here on 91.9 or any of the NRN stations. Leadership, certainly something that we have had a lot of discussion in the last multiple years as to whether or not you agree or disagree with the leadership that's going on. But leadership, coming from the McIntyre School of Commerce, I assume goes a little bit beyond politics. How do you teach a class on leadership to what I suppose are a lot of 20, 21, 22-year-olds?
Well, we use a variety of approaches. We've got a new minor being offered in leadership at UVA, and it's based in the comm school, but it's open to students of all majors, so we make it multidisciplinary. I'm teaching a large lecture course that for second years, which means it's full of students of all majors, and we use lecture, video, cases, articles. We have guest speakers. We have a few guest speakers from other departments around UVA. We've got guest speakers from outside of UVA, so variety is one of the things. And so, it's definitely an academic subject with research and theory as well as practical application to work with.
Well, I think that's one of the first questions that we need to have is it possible to teach leadership, the entire nature versus nurture aspect of being born with the skills and the style that makes you a leader and learning the steps. How do you explain the two, the difference of the two, the nature and the nurture aspect to me?
That's a good opening question. The way it's usually phrased is, are leaders born or made? And I think most people can think of people they see or saw as born leaders and wish they were one of those born leaders. And that's the same as the nature-nurture question. Most people, including me, would come down strongly on the nurture side of things. That is, leaders are made or they learn as they grow and develop. And the bottom line, as far as I'm concerned in teaching it, is that everybody can learn to become a better leader.
And, you know, there's so much of this. Just to get started on the basics, feel free to dial us up today. I think there's going to be a lot of questions. 979-0919. Obviously, this is a topic that reaches well out into our listening area. 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS is a toll-free number. So 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, 979-0919. University of Virginia Professor Tom Bateman is here with us today. Sean is back to answer the phones and patch you through or to pass along your question if you'd just like to have it read. So nature versus nurture. You obviously, as a professor, you are going to come down on the side of the ability to teach someone to be a leader. All right, tell me what makes a leader. I'm curious what the aspects are, because I would think that there are both parts of that, that some people are born with natural aspects of leadership, and then to fine-tune it, to make them competent, which we'll get into shortly, that those things could be taught. So give me the, you know, the five characteristics or however many there are that make you a leader?
That's a question that has been asked forever, and researchers, scholars have tried to answer it forever. I'll tell you what, I'll start with a couple of things that seem to be more born than made, or at least seem in some ways. So for one thing, extroversion is a personality trait compared to introversion. People like to ask and know what personality traits are most important. Extroverts, that's kind of a biochemical personality trait based in physiology and heredity to some degree. Extroverts are more likely to enjoy being the center of attention and maybe more comfortable being in the position of leader. Introverts a little more likely to shy away and not want to volunteer to be the point person. But in the end, they don't have much to do with how good a person is at being a leader. So extroverts might be more likely to want it. Introverts might be less likely to want to be a leader, but it doesn't really affect their effectiveness as leaders. The things that matter in terms of being a good leader are other things that can be taught and learned. To follow up, charisma is a word that most people use. They see people that they figure were born charismatic. They've got that special glow that I wasn't lucky enough to be born with. I wish I had. But you know what? There's been plenty of research done on charisma, and it's not a mystical, magical pixie dust thing. People can learn to do things that make them seem more charismatic to others.
Good fashion.
You mean looking good?
How you dress? That's why I'm on the radio.
Right. Okay. I'll start with one example. By the way, Barack Obama comes to mind. He is, you know, fashionable and good looking and so forth, and that doesn't hurt him. But beyond that, there are more substantive things people can do. For instance, most business people know that leaders are supposed to have a vision. That is to know where they want to go, where they want to lead and take people, and to be able to articulate what that vision is and be able to communicate it in a way that's compelling to other people. Well, if you don't have a vision and can't communicate it, you will not have charisma.
Is that something that you were born with, the ability to see or spot the vision through the clouds, or is that something that you learn?
Not something you were born with, something you learn and something you make a point of doing. So many managers, leaders basically need to be told that they haven't been painting the picture of where they want to go. And they can just make the decision, I've got to start doing that, and I've got to learn how to convey it, and I've got to take advantage of every opportunity to convey it. That will ratchet up a person's charisma, and it's not something that you're either born with or not. It's something you've got to make a decision to do.
We are here with University of Virginia Professor Tom Bateman. I guess not, maybe not the last, but one of the articles that led to this guest today, Leading for Results, Brief but Powerful Lessons from Katrina and Iraq. So we are going to talk about leadership throughout the hour, and obviously we will be drilling into that. 979-0919-1877, WNRN Rocks. Tom, competency. We've talked about nature versus nurture, and I think that we'll continue to hit on that throughout the hour. But wherever you get your leadership skills, there has to be some form of competency if you're going to last. As you can say, I'm going to step up and be the leader. But whether or not you do that for a long period of time or are very quickly asked to step down or forced down, I would assume is based on competency. So what qualifies as competent? What do we want in our leaders?
Well, I guess I would start by saying we seem to want charisma. One author says that people are charisma hungry. But that's not exactly the substance that's going to deliver results over a long period of time. I'm actually working on a paper right now that is saying that most of what we think about with regard to leadership is how to be interpersonally competent, how to deal with people, which of course is important. But ultimately, over time, what matters also is not just charisma, and how other people view you in terms of your personality and your style and so forth. But ultimately, it's about delivering results, and it takes substance and competence to deliver results. So I'll start with the point regarding competence that leaders have to know what they're doing. They have got to have a knowledge base and some expertise that matters to what the team or organization are trying to accomplish. And then beyond that, I would elaborate by saying it's very much how the leader with his or her team solves problems, tackles issues, and over time deliver results. And that's different from just pure style in the classic sense of charisma.
When you talk about deciding what to do, who does this for a leader? Does a true leader, does the best leader identify the work or the goal, or can someone else say, this is what we would like done, now go lead others to that destination?
That brings up a couple of major points, I think. One is what is commonly said is that the ultimate act of leadership is to develop other leaders. So to the extent that a leader is delegating to others and coaching, modeling, teaching them to be better leaders themselves, that's usually a good thing. And I'm not referring, of course, to just dumping on everybody else. But delegating in a productive way. The traditional perspective on leadership over the centuries and millennia has been leadership as a top-down, I'm the boss, I am the all-knowing teller of truth, I make decisions, you do what I tell you.
Dictatorship-style leading?
Well, yes, and that applies politically and literally in some countries, but also, you know, business leaders are sometimes described that way. I'm the boss. I make the decisions, give the orders. If you do what I want, I will reward you somehow. Maybe if you don't, I will punish you somehow. That's kind of the classic top-down leadership. Today, what is more, recent and more powerful is to distribute leadership throughout the organization. So the leader oversees leadership by lots of people who are finding the problems that need to be tackled, spotting the opportunities that need to be pursued, and mobilizing people to go after them.
Can you be a great leader? Do you have to be a great leader because you found where you want, where you want the end result to be? Or can you also be a great leader if someone says, lead your group, your committee, your country, your state to this point?
Well, if you've identified it yourself, the odds are you're a little more motivated and passionate about it, and that is likely to be a plus, of course. More ideally, especially when we're talking about a complex world with lots of options to pursue, ideally the vision comes from the involvement of multiple people who have useful perspective. So if you're the top leader, you're not thinking it through all by yourself. You're working with others to figure it out together. Then the whole group is more likely to be more motivated to pursue it. By the way, to the extent that a leader has done it all him or herself, identified the vision and keeps pounding on it, there ought to be sort of checkpoints about the progress, and there ought to be open lines of communication for others to say, things have changed. Maybe we need to revisit the vision. Or we're off path somehow. Maybe we need to revisit our strategies and tactics. So much of problem solving and opportunity pursuit needs to be a collaborative effort as opposed to a person at the top effort.
How does that describe leadership? Let me back up a second. We are talking with University of Virginia professor Tom Bateman about leadership, a recent article he's written, Leading for Results: Brief but Powerful Lessons from Katrina and Iraq, and we'll be getting into that after the first break. Being the guy at the top who says, this is how we'll do it, even if that method leads you to complete and utter success, versus the person at the top who has some form of some group who's also offering advice, who's checking as you go along to say, slightly off path, maybe we ought to look at it this way. Who's a little the leader who's a little more open to thoughts and ideas, but who also takes you to complete and utter success. Is one better or worse than the other, or are you talking about just end results here?
Well, it sounds to me like the second one you describe is likely to be better in the long run if the solitary autocratic leader has identified the right task and pursues it to success. Obviously, great. With the team involved more, it's more likely that the right task will be identified. And especially over time, you've got to pursue multiple opportunities. You've got to deal with multiple problems. Much of leadership is about which ones should we deal with and which ones aren't important enough right now. And you're far more likely to make the right decisions if you're getting other input. One of the problems with being a president of the United States, for instance, is to end up in a bubble where you're not hearing much truth from other people. Your cadre of advisors gets smaller and smaller, and it might become one that tells you only what you want to hear or thinks exactly like you, and you get shut off from the real feedback that leaders need to hear.
979-0919-1877-WNRN-ROCKS. And if you want to send that instant message, it's WNRN Studio on the AOL instant message screen. Where this last one comes from, Professor, talk about delegating versus dumping. And I guess we'll go back for a couple minutes because you said that the better leader knows how to delegate appropriately versus just dumping something on someone else. So that listener wants to know, what's the difference and how do you identify the two?
First off, delegation is one of the most fundamental and important dynamics of the relationship between a boss and his or her employee. Tasks get assigned all the time. As a starting point, I suppose dumping in my mind means that leaders just give all the tasks to other people and kind of wash their hands of it and are no longer attentive to it and not likely to coach or be there to help or cover somebody's back, as they say, if mistakes are made. A better delegation process is to figure out who is best for this assignment, to delegate it to the right person, to give them some freedom, but also to monitor enough so that major mistakes aren't made, or if mistakes are made, we can recover quickly enough. Ideally, delegation involves the leader in the sense of coaching and stretching and developing the employee who's got the new task, as opposed to washing the leader's hands of it and just sitting back. And when mistakes are made, blame the subordinate rather than realize I didn't do a good job of delegating.
It sounds like, and I'm standing here trying not to bring up too much of my personal work thing here, but delegating is putting someone else in a position where they can succeed at doing the task that needs to get done. But what if I don't want to do that task? I do not want to review that person. I don't want to give that other employee their evaluation. And I so want, you know, my immediate, underling, whatever, my immediate assistant to do that for me because they know how. I trust that they can do it because they've done them in the past. Please, you're assigned to that job. What's the difference between delegating and dumping in that sense?
In that case, that is still delegating, of course. It's not so much dumping. Dumping obviously implies a negative thing. It's not that case is not so negative because, as you put it, you know that person can do it. You trust them fully to do it. So in that case, you don't need to monitor so much. And it sounds like it's appropriate to delegate from that person. Dumping to me, part of it is when leaders are perceived by their followers or their direct reports as someone who is not willing to get his hands dirty like the rest of us. And they just want to stay aloof from the action.
So I do. I am a good dumper then.
Okay, congratulations.
All right.
Okay.
11:20 on the wake-up call, University Professor Tom Bateman. As we talk about leadership, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN rocks. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Sunny in the morning, partly cloudy this afternoon. Today, highs 85 to 90. Partly cloudy tonight, lows 60 to 65. Mostly sunny tomorrow, highs 85 to 90. Right now in the valley, it's a pretty sunny day all around. 82 over there, 82 in Lynchburg, 83 in Richmond, 84 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let me thank Blue Ridge Graphics for supporting us today. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street, serving Charlottesville with custom t-shirts, sportswear, and professional graphic design since 1979. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and at brgtshirts.com. And WNRN also wants to take a moment and remind those of you who made pledges to the just-completed fund drive, but who haven't paid them yet, to please do so as soon as possible. People who can take your payment and help you with your premiums are here until 7 p.m. most weekdays and often later. And on weekends, if you call first, we're at 2250 Old Ivy Road in Charlottesville behind the Ivy Inn restaurant. If you're mailing in your pledge, it's 22903. The first round of written reminders to those with unpaid pledges have gone out recently. And thanks again to those who have already honored your pledge. To help us reach nearly 94% of collection on the over 94,000% pledged. That's pretty good, 94% on 94,000. All right, let's see. Put your headphones on there, Tom. Because we got Gary online, too. Hey, Gary.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Another interesting guest. Appreciate these programs on Sunday morning. I wanted to ask a couple questions. I'm one who doesn't necessarily believe, for example, that you have to have played a sport to coach it. I think you can learn how to coach and, in a sense, how to lead. Obviously, there's a good perspective if you've played and then can relate that to what you're leading. But in relationship to that, I'd like to know a little bit more about Professor Bateman's background in terms of what he has led that has brought him to the point where he can teach leadership. And the other question I had is, who in American industry right now would he recommend to his students as good leaders? And I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks, Gary.
Okay, thank you, Gary. My leadership background has been primarily in, well, sports for one thing, but also academic life. I've been department chair, PhD program coordinator, leaders of projects. I suppose project leadership is one of the main things I've been doing. I'm director of a new program at UVA, and I've been doing things like that for about 30 years. I lead consulting projects, educational programs in business and industry all around the world, and I've been doing research on this forever. Leaders in industry. I actually said to Rick before the program that it's hard to talk about that at some level because so often the currently great leaders in business are profiled in Fortune magazine and other places, and the next thing you know, they're brought down hard by either circumstances changing and them failing to adapt, or ethical scandals or whatever. So you put a name out that's hot now, and the next thing you know, it's not a good answer. Certainly, one thing we do in classes is to teach using cases. Current students may think it's passé now, but you know, Fortune magazine named Jack Welch the manager of the century, the greatest business leader of the 20th century, based primarily on business results, including the value created for shareholders and the growth in the company and GE and so forth. But also stylistically and in terms of the processes he created and implemented. He was a remarkable innovator and pioneer in so many ways.
So Welch from GE?
Jack Welch of GE, right. And
okay.
And he remains, he's flawed. I mean, his reputation suffered in the wake of an ugly divorce and what came out about his retirement package and so forth. But what remains to be learned from him is fairly incredible. His predecessor, Jeffrey Immelt at GE, I'm very impressed with him also. Although under current circumstances, it's so tough, and he's got his critics, but he's a current one about whom I don't have a case that I teach, but he's one who impresses me. By the way, you mentioned sports. I love to draw examples from the great sports coaches. I do some things with adventure and the world of exploration. Great leaders in every walk of life. I try to use in class.
Such as who?
One of the things,
I would think that the people that you're praising are not gonna, give you a hard time. And as we get a little bit into the ones who aren't or do not have such a great reputation as leaders. So who are some of the ones aside from Jack Welch that you are, mentioning to your students?
Some of the non-business leaders, is that what you're asking?
Yeah. About? I mean, you talked about how you draw from the sports world. So who?
Well, sports, Mike Krzyzewski is one. I hate to say that,
Why? Because he's a Duke man?
Of course. And he's got a new book out, by the way, that I'm looking forward to reading. In the world of adventure exploration, I actually went on a couple of adventure trips in the last couple of years in Africa, and one of them was led by a fairly famous world explorer named Pasquale Scaturo, who was the first man to do the descent of the Nile River, the entire river from source to sea. There's an IMAX movie about him. He led the expedition to the top of Everest, Mount Everest, that included a blind climber. He led the group in which the first ever blind climber summited Everest. And I was fortunate enough to go on an expedition with Pasquale, and he was an amazing leader, so I use him. I'll give you one other quick example. One video we work with in one of my classes is a documentary-style production of the race to the South Pole, to be the first to reach the South Pole, between Captain Scott, the Brit, and Amundsen, the Norwegian. This took place in 1911 and 1912. So it's very goal-oriented, a head-to-head competition, and two very different leadership styles. And we have a good time working with that as an example, different from the standard.
What are the different leadership styles? Because to me, that's one of the things. Gary talks about the fact that you don't have to have played the sport to be good at teaching it or leading in it. But I'm curious as to, I'd like to hear the two different styles, because I still can't wrap my mind around the fact that you can teach a 20-year-old how to be a good leader. I can see where you can teach them, here, watch this movie about this person who is a good leader, mm-hmm. and here are the ABC factors of why we think they are, but I'm having a hard time believing that person can then go pick up on those three and become a good leader themselves.
Yeah, great question. A basic difference between those two leaders. Scott, the Brit, was a very autocratic, almost dictatorial, top-down, I'm the boss, solitary decision-maker. Amundsen, the Norwegian, much more respect for the opinions of his men, much more collaborative. Both tough, smart, impressive guys, but very different in their styles with regard to the way they interacted with their men and with regard to the way they made decisions autocratically versus more democratically. The students can it's a completely different context from what my students, also my executive and management adult students, live in. But for starters, I make the point about how the context is actually not as different as you might think. Being the first to the South Pole is all about risk-taking and venturing into an uncertain future, which is what today's business, challenges are. But I'm always able to say, think about yourself in this regard. You see Captain Scott act like an autocrat. Think about when and how often you act like an autocrat when you're in a team meeting or study group meeting or something. and think about coaches you've had, teachers you've had, summer bosses you've had, et cetera, et cetera.
I'd assume that it takes a different type of, I can't think of the proper word. I keep wanting to come back to underling because I watched some movie last night. But I would think that as the leader, if you're going to be an autocrat, it requires a different type of member of your group to be successful than if you were the leader who shared and who seeked feedback. That if you didn't have different types of people in your group, that neither of you may be successful with that style. You need a different style of membership, personality of your membership to do that.
You know what you're getting at, broadly speaking, and it's a big, big point. When most people think about leadership, they think about the traits, characteristics, attributes, style of the leader, and they tend to ignore the fact that situations differ. And different situations require different things. So one thing you're saying, it depends on your followers. Some followers are more willing and able to take orders and just passively obey them. Some followers don't want to make decisions. They'd rather sit back and have the leader make decisions. Others will push back some. One of the great moments of the video about Amundsen versus Scott in the South Pole is when one of the more assertive pushback kind of followers says to one of the passive, obedient, blindly obedient followers, "Can I ask you something?" He says, "Is loyalty to the leader the most important thing, or is pure reason the most important thing?" And what he's saying is, so many people blindly follow bad decisions, and there needs to be some thought and some pushback to maybe disagree sometimes. The best leaders will ask for opinions. The best followers will offer information that the leader might need to hear it, as opposed to blindly obey. And of course, if the people are not in the right mix, it's not a good a relationship, and maybe the follower would be better off in some other job or with some other boss.
It just seems like that the leader who may be the autocratic leader who may be successful in one situation and be quite successful and receive much, wonderful feedback from the rest of the world would be just completely dumbfounded and lose early at their goal if they had a different set of people working with them.
Well, two quick reactions to that. One is, yes, you've got the followers that you have, and you need to adjust your style to a certain degree to the followers that you have. But also, to a certain degree, you create the followers that you have. You choose them sometimes you don't. But you can develop them, or you can teach them a new culture. We were talking before we went on air about the cultures that bosses create. You can set in motion the processes that develop your people in new and different ways to get them to think differently. If you want pushback, ask for it, even though they've had a history of not pushing back, or vice versa. You create a culture, and you can do things to develop followers to think and behave the way you need them to.
University of Virginia Professor Tom Bateman here from the McIntyre School of Commerce. As we talk about leadership, feel free to dial up with your question, your comment, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS is the toll-free number, WNRN Studio, if you want to send that instant message. Tom's recent article, Leading for Results, Brief but Powerful Lessons from Katrina and Iraq. And let's jump into that, Tom. I'm reading this article, and you talked about New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin. And as a lot of people know, the levees were determined for decades to be not as good as they should be. And, of course, much of this, while the experts are saying this before Katrina, much of the national or it didn't get it, it got much greater notoriety after Katrina, and they failed. So my question is about elected leaders. Do elected leaders have a different expectation, or are they put under a different microscope than a committee leader, someone who just rises to the top because, and I'll, you know, bring this out. A lot of elected leaders are considered to be poor leaders after the failure. But an elected leader is also oftentimes doing what his citizenship or those who elected him want him to do. In Nagin's point, he was focusing on the murder rates, the school system, and so the levies fell a little further down the list. And it was only after Katrina that people said, why weren't you doing that? Look at the decades of talk that there's been about this and all these experts who said it. Why didn't you do that? So I'm curious about the role that an elected leader such as Ray Nagin during Katrina is put in.
Yeah, they, you know, obviously one of their, you know, people, leaders like everybody else is motivated by their own personal goals, are motivated by their own personal goals. One of the goals of politicians is to get reelected. That's a different kind of goal from what so many other leaders have to deal with. Reelection requires paying attention to what voters want and demand. By the way, you mentioned citizens. One of the themes of my course is that leadership is not about the person at the top, not only about the person at the top. And one type of leader called citizen leader are the citizens who step up to fill the void that the politicians are not delivering on. So in the case of New Orleans, for instance, the scientists and the civic activists who were making noise about the need for change with the levies, those are citizen leaders, although unfortunately they were not influential enough to be attended to by the top. This also cycles back to the importance of leaders identifying the right problems that need to be tackled. And this was a problem that needed to be tackled but did not get addressed adequately. The broader theme of that article is something I said earlier, that so often people want charisma and personality, and maybe including your question, attention to what I'm asking you about if I'm the average citizen. But great leadership is about ultimately going after the problems that most need to be tackled. And there's a case of short-term pressures crowding out a bigger long-term problem. We live in a short-term world, but the big problems we need to deal with are the longer-term, bigger ones.
All right, we'll jump back on that in a moment. We got Scott from Charlottesville. Hey, Scott.
Hey. Just sort of a brief comment, maybe if he wants to expand on this, great. One of the things I've observed sort of over my lifetime is I really find, number one, I view giving somebody, playing the devil's advocate for them, to be a beneficial thing. I like it when people do that with me. I feel like it only strengthens my argument to have to respond to their points. But I found over the years that there aren't very many people who are comfortable with that sort of thing, and in some ways I think, particularly politically, our situation has become one where you win the argument by getting as many people who agree with you as possible. So if you have somebody you think isn't agreeing with you, that means they're sort of not on your side. So it's a winner-take-all thing. Any thoughts on either of those kind of concepts as far as leadership goes?
I think you're right on the money. This is back to one of our opening points about leaders need to think not only by themselves, but think with the opinions and brains of their colleagues and others. And ideally, this includes people with different opinions. Not to get overly political here, but from what I can tell, President Bush was not much willing to listen to different viewpoints. President Obama, at least on the campaign trail, tried to make it clear that he invited and welcomed other opinions, and that's what you're talking about. I admire that's your approach. If nobody's playing devil's advocate, you should invite someone to play a devil's advocate, which is to say shoot holes in your approach. There's another technique kind of related but kind of different called dialectical inquiry, which is to maybe assign half of your team to make a case for doing X and assign the other half of your team to make the case for doing why. Some companies do that with merger or acquisition decisions. A green team makes the case for going after it. The red team makes the case for not going after that. And that is even better than devil's advocacy. That ensures that at least two options are fully thought out, which is a more thorough process than just a devil's advocate shooting holes in one idea. But I'm totally with you on your point. And I agree with you too. So many people are not comfortable with that. And it's a good thing to be comfortable with it. It can make things more fun to talk about, let alone make for better quality decisions. As long as the disagreement remains focused on the decision and doesn't become a personal, emotional, you're a jerk, how can you think like that kind of a disagreement.
I'm still here. I have a follow-up question if I have time.
Yes, sir.
I guess the other thing that seems to happen, particularly in national political issues, going, for instance, with the Iraq War, that at some point leaders propose we're past the point where you should even be debating this, and there's the disloyalty or unpatriotic comes in, obviously, with the Iraq War. At some point when the decision was sort of made, people who questioned it were called unpatriotic simply for questioning it, because by that time you should already be on board. Does that happen in corporate culture too? Once a decision's made, if you continue to provide rational explanations for why something shouldn't happen, are you branded disloyal?
Very interesting question, and definitely Iraq is a great example of that. I think what most corporate executives, leaders want, I think it's implied in your question. They say they invite disagreement. And especially if they do want disagreement, when they want it is before the decision is made. Once the decision is made, though, they mostly want people to clam up and just get on board and throw yourselves into making sure the decision works out properly. That's not to say a follower should never cycle back. There may come a point when you can have the conversation, things have changed or it's not going very well and we ought to talk about it. And leaders ought to invite that once in a while. But ultimately, it's kind of an idiosyncratic thing, and the follower needs to figure out whether this is the type of boss I can raise it with again, or is it not. And by the way, too, this brings us to the point of picking your battles. There are some battles worth picking and other battles not worth picking. That applies in the corporate world as much as the political world.
University of Virginia Professor Tom Bateman here as we talk about leadership. Leading for results, brief but powerful lessons from Katrina and Iraq. Dial us up, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Over the years, countless cougar sightings have yielded no hard proof of those big cats in Central Virginia. But coyotes are definitely here, and that means trouble for livestock, pets, and possibly more. And The Hook takes a look into the accusation that Ravana Sewer and Water Authority lost potential revenue, not just to a competitor, but to one of their own partners. The Hook, a big fan of sundresses and seersuckers, especially on Fox Field weekends. And support for NRN Today coming from Blue Ridge Mountain Sports, where spring means it's time to come in and get outfitted for trail running or hiking. This weekend, Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is featuring Keen footwear and bags. Details are in this week's Hook and Seaville, as well as at brms.com. You'll find Blue Ridge Mountain Sports in the Barrack Road Shopping Center here in Charlottesville, at Wintergreen, and in Richmond. And don't go anywhere, because at noon, it's Les Temps Perdue with Drew Thompson, bringing you the best from college, alternative, and underground scenes from the 80s and 90s. You'll hear the early efforts of some of today's biggest acts and cult classics you haven't heard in years. Remember, at least one song heard during the second hour of Les Temps will be featured on the Plan 9 pop quiz the following week. That's Les Temps Perdue at noon, only on WNRN. All right, back with Professor Bateman. Professor, the article that you've written about lessons from Katrina and Iraq, obviously two very large incidents, events in the last several years here in the United States, but why those two? I think we could all name one or two more or other events, but why those two?
Well, they both are two of the most momentous events in our lifetimes, and they converge on, they're, you know, totally different things, of course, but they converge on the need for competence. And in both cases, I saw a lack of leadership and a lack of competent leadership. They also sort of converge on some pretty simple lessons that I think it's an important point that a lot of people know intellectually the important things for leaders to do, but don't act on that knowledge. So one of the opening, well, toward the end of the article, it concludes with some lessons. And one of the lessons is that leaders show up. Ray Nagin didn't much show up during Katrina. He was invisible. He was apparently, well, people say he was frightened. I don't presume to know what was in his head, but he just didn't show up. President Bush flew over New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, and it was several days. I don't know how long. It was a while before he actually showed up, et cetera, et cetera. Katrina makes a point about choosing your battles. What goals are you going to go after? And he, like, by the way, Nagin wasn't the only one. Many mayors before him had neglected this huge issue, this huge long-term issue. And then Iraq was an example of an invasion competently executed, but the aftermath terribly incompetently executed. The other reason I chose Iraq was a great example of lower-level leaders doing an excellent job, but the top leaders not doing a competent job. And I wanted to make that point in the article, explaining that there's a term, distributed leadership or shared leadership, which is about the fact that leadership today requires leaders bubbling up and doing their jobs from the lower and middle levels of the organization and in all corners of the organization. Leadership is not just something at the top. And the good things that were done with Katrina were done by the Coast Guard and General Honoré, who came, and not the visible politicians at the top, governor or president or Homeland Security, et cetera. Iraq, likewise, amazing stories of courage and heroism and great leadership with regard to the military and civilian life. And some of the mid and lower level diplomats and so forth fortunately stepped up and did some great things that were not being adequately directed from the top.
Is it possible for, and this isn't just directed at you, but is it possible for the average person well-versed in leadership as a topic or not to identify someone as being a great leader if you don't necessarily agree with their political viewpoints, or vice versa?
Yeah,
if you are a diehard Republican, could you identify with President Bush as being not a good leader? Or if you were if you would agree with him on so many points, and it works the other way, if you're a diehard Republican, could you say that Obama is a wonderful leader?
I'm seeing, and maybe others, probably others too, are seeing that happening with both presidents and both sides of the political spectrum. President Bush, no doubt the people that consider him still a good leader are the ones who agree with him on policy issues. But lots of Republicans turned on him as the Iraq war went south, the occupation, that is, and with Katrina. That's when his popularity dropped off the map regarding competence on the right as well as the political left. Obama as well. There are plenty of Republicans who see good things there. And I'm not sure everybody's convinced yet, but they see things about his process that gives them hope for the potential as a leader. So in my classes, I try to leave my political opinions out of it and try to talk about their processes and styles, the way they think and the way they interact. One thing that made me hopeful about Obama is not so much necessarily his policy positions, but that he seemed to welcome alternative viewpoints, and he seemed to be focused on problem solving as opposed to ideology. And that's an important distinction. So problem solving for results can be there or not be there, regardless of whether a political leader is a Republican or a Democrat. I think it's more likely to be there if they're not an ideologue. And so I would suggest to people to think in terms of their processes as opposed to their ideologies, except in the case where a voter's personal ideology is so important that it trumps the problem-solving skills and results orientation more broadly.
University Professor Tom Bateman here as we talk about leadership for the hour, 11:50 on the wake-up call. Still time to call in or send an instant message if you'd like. WNRN Studio on the AOL instant message screen, 979-0919. Locally, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, toll-free. Professor, you touched on it just with that last comment. What's the difference between making a decision and truly problem-solving?
Well, if I can sound academic for a minute.
Briefly, please.
Yeah.
It is early Sunday for me.
Yeah, and I think without much jargon, real quick, problem-solving is a process of first picking what problem you're going to tackle, identifying a problem, deciding what your goals are as you try to solve the problem, thinking through what all your options are, choosing one of your options, and then implementing the options, and then following up to see how it's going. I mean, that's about 6 or 7 stages I just mentioned there that comprise problem solving. Decision making is just the one in the middle, choosing, am I going to do X or am I going to do Y? But problem solving is a much bigger domain, starting with what am I going to tackle? What are my options? And then which of those options am I going to try? And following from that is the other problem solving things of implementation and follow up and adapting as needed.
So I can flip a coin to make the decision, but flipping the coin does not qualify as solving the problem.
Right. Not remotely. Not remotely.
That sucks. All right. As we wind down our hour, we talked earlier, I think when you mentioned Jack Welch from GE, in no way did you identify him as being ethical or unethical, but we did talk about how identifying some of the better leaders sometimes turned out later on, but what role do ethics play in leadership?
Obviously, very important. Poor ethics are obviously a source of downfall for a leader. Good ethics not only avoid the downfall, the ethical downfall, but they also make the leader more appealing to multiple constituencies, multiple stakeholders. And they also add to a person's charisma. If a person's got strong values that appeal to other people's values, that's a source of charisma. If ethics is not so much relevant to a leader or his or her style, there's an opportunity cost in the sense that that's a source of charisma lost, let alone the ultimate possible positive impact that can be derived from those ethics. By the way, there's a big difference between being an ethical person, which most of us consider ourselves to be, and being an ethical leader, which is to say, voice your values, put them on the table, create a culture where our values and our ethics are explicit rather than hoped for. and create a culture where everybody's thinking ethically and behaving ethically. That's being a visible ethical leader, as opposed to being a person who is ethical but isn't really leading through ethics. I will say, if I were, I've just recently sort of landed on a trio of things. If I were to give a short answer to what makes for great leadership, it is a combination, coincidentally, of things that start with the letter C: charisma, competence, and character. And character is where the ethics thing comes in. If you've, you know, leadership is infinitely complicated. If you've got those three things going for you, that would be pretty awesome in its impact.
We are talking about leadership here as we wind down the hour. University Professor Tom Bateman. Let me thank 45fix.com for supporting us today. If you have a home improvement project, there's another way to find a contractor. It's 45fix.com. From remodeling to repair projects, immediate, no obligation estimates, available anytime. That's 45fix.com. It's the number 4 and the number 5 and the word fix.com. And this is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS-FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. 11:56 here on the hour. Professor, can you lead from the outside? And let me explain that a little bit. I can't think of the gentleman's name. He's the older gentleman, very wealthy, who's now all about doing wind.
That would be T. Boone Pickens, maybe?
T. Boone Pickens. Thank you. I see Sean rushing in to help me save the day. Because my vision of Mr. Pickens is that while he's doing his thing about the wind turbines, is that much of his effort at leadership is to stand outside and comment about the rights and wrongs of other people, of other leaders, elected or not. Can you be a leader in that sense?
Sure, and that's the role of a citizen leader, for one thing. To speak to T. Boone Pickens for a minute, he was a very successful oil and gas man, Oklahoman, I think, and achieved great fortune in that industry, and now has completely shifted his focus. His critics are saying that this is just his latest business venture, and this is all about trying to make new money in new ways. Others are loving the fact that he is thinking in new ways for the new era and will be an important voice in alternative energies. So, you know, there's no easy way to answer from afar what his motives are. It's probably a combination of things. He has a great demonstrated track record of competence, and that will help him be effective as a leader. That also adds to a person's charisma, by the way. Knowing that a person is rich and successful and famous confers charisma on a person. So I suspect he'll be pretty successful in these pursuits. But the broader question is all about the role of citizen leaders and people who are outside the political sphere or the major corporate sphere. You know, this cycles back to one of your early questions, Rick, or one of your early comments. Leadership is talked about so much lately. People call it a crisis of leadership. Where are the leaders? We don't have enough. We don't have enough good ones. People have actually, there's a kind of semi-well-known phrase, the crisis of leadership. There's just not enough of them. The point of that is there need to be more. They need to step up from everywhere. And by the way, the crisis of leadership has existed more or less forever. There's so much to be done. There's so many vacuums out there that need to be filled. And leadership needs to come from every walk of life. And a lot of the keys to success as an outside leader are stem from the kinds of things we've been talking about today, about the way you demonstrate competence, the way you interact with people, the aspects of charisma, including vision and communicating the vision, the ethics, the character, et cetera, et cetera.
All right. Believe it or not, it's already 11:59. Time to finish up. Professor Bateman, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Enjoyed it a lot.
Leadership, you can find it on the podcast later today. www.sevillepodcast.com, and you can make comments on the show if you'd like. Next week we'll be doing a show about job loss. I'll have a gentleman in here who showed up at work one day to find out he'd been laid off, despite the fact that he's married with two young children. And I'll have a woman in here who owns a business and has been forced to decide who to lay off. So be here next Sunday. Professor Bateman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Les Thames-Perdue up next. Adios.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasolines, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.